following is a lecture given by His Grace Prabhupada Prabhu on Srimad Bhagavatam, 3rd Canto, 19th Chapter, Text 37. The lecture is given in San Diego on April 15, 1992.
O Brahmanas, anyone who hears, chants, or takes pleasure in the wonderful narration of the killing of the Hiranyaksha demon by the Lord, who appeared as the first boar in order to deliver the world, is at once relieved of the results of sinful activities, even the killing of a brahmana. Since the personality of Godhead is in the absolute position, there is no difference between his pastimes and his personality. Anyone who hears about the pastimes of the Lord associates with the Lord directly, and one who associates directly with the Lord is certainly freed from all sinful activities, even to the extent of the killing of a brahmana, which is considered the most sinful activity in the material world. One should be very eager to hear about the activities of the Lord from the bona fide source, the pure devotee. If one simply gives oral reception to the narration and accepts the glories of the Lord, then he is qualified. The impersonalist philosophers cannot understand the activities of the Lord. They think that all his activities are maya, therefore they are called mayavadis. Since everything to them is maya, these narrations are not for them. Some impersonalists are reluctant to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, although many of them are now taking an interest in it just for monetary gain. Actually, however, they have no faith. On the contrary, they describe it in their own way. We should not hear, therefore, from the mayavadis. We have to hear from Suta Goswami or Maitreya, who actually present the narrations as they are, and only then can we relish the pastimes of the Lord. Otherwise, the effects on the neophyte audience will be poisonous.
Om Jnana Timurandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militanyena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitanyena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam.
Translation. O Brahmanas, anyone who hears, chants, or takes pleasure in the wonderful narration of the killing of the Hiranyaksha demon by the Lord, who appeared as the first boar in order to deliver the world, is at once relieved of the results of sinful activities, even the killing of a brahmana. So, this is summing up the story of the pastime of Lord Varaha and the killing of Hiranyaksha. So, Srila Prabhupada is pointing out in the purport that the by hearing and chanting the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in a proper frame of mind, one is actually associating directly with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So this is possible because Krishna is absolute. And therefore anything connected with Krishna, if properly appreciated, is actually non-different from Krishna. So you can actually come in contact with the absolute truth, supreme absolute truth, by hearing these pastimes. So that's the remarkable feature of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, Srila Prabhupada also mentions the impersonalist philosophers and says that these narrations are not for them. So the concept of the impersonalist philosophers is that the supreme absolute truth is something non-personal in nature. Hence, they're called impersonalists. They also have an approach to understanding the absolute truth, which is different from that of the Bhagavatas, or the devotees of the Lord. The devotees of the Lord want to glorify the pastimes of Krishna, and in this way they actually come into the association of Krishna. But if the supreme absolute truth is something impersonal, then of course that method is not going to be appropriate for learning about the absolute truth. And in fact, the approach of the impersonalists is generally to understand the Supreme Absolute Truth through jnana, or knowledge. They want to use the power of their minds to figure out the nature of the Absolute Truth. So, this is a very standard thing for people to try to do. In all different human societies, you find this kind of philosophy being presented. Now, the original Mayavadi philosophy of Shankaracharya is quite curious because he actually accepts the reality of Krishna. This isn't widely appreciated today. Nowadays, you'll find that Mayavadi philosophy is accepted everywhere. In universities in the United States today, for example, it's respectable to be interested in Eastern philosophy, which means Mayavadi philosophy. However, Krishna consciousness is not at all respectable. That's the situation. So, generally, though, people do not appreciate what Shankaracharya was actually saying. Actually, in his version, Krishna is real. The different expansions of Vishnu are real. The demigods are real. Likewise, we're real. At least we're real on the same platform. But it's all Maya. And the Absolute Truth is the impersonal Brahman, about which any description you can give of it is false and misleading. Any concept that you have of it is also false, because your concept is also Maya. So therefore, it is beyond words. And so one needn't say anything about it, except that people tend to go on saying quite a lot. But the key point there is that Shankaracharya is saying that Krishna is at least as real as we are, or as real as this world is. It's just that it's all Maya. And also, there's a within this Maya, there's a pattern of cause and effect. And Krishna is the ultimate cause within that pattern of cause and effect, which is Maya, which actually doesn't exist. This is the philosophy of Shankaracharya. So, that's not generally recognized, that Shankaracharya would say that Krishna is just as real as we are. So he actually exists. This can be a little bit, can lead to tricky considerations, because Shankaracharya has some hymns in praise of Krishna, and they sound just like what you would hear from a devotee. But one shouldn't be fooled, because in fact he's praising the glories of that which does not exist in the same sense that the world and ourselves also do not exist. And the only thing that really exists is something about which any statement you make would be misleading. So that's the actual Shankaracharya philosophy. It's a bit of a difficult philosophy. Now, the philosophy which goes under the name of Shankaracharya's philosophy and which is accepted widely today would say that, yes, the world is Maya. We're also Maya as persons. We don't really exist. But the Krishna exists to an even lesser extent, because Krishna is just mythology. That would be the modern accepted version. And what you will find is that people try to graft together physics and Shankaracharya's philosophy. The way they do that is say that the physicists are completely right in everything they say, in which case what they're saying is that reality consists ultimately of some kind of energy field in which waves are propagating, and that's it. And everything that we see is produced from this energy field by transformation, and the name for this is evolution. So the energy field produced the Big Bang, and in the Big Bang, gases condensed out and galaxies condensed from the gases, stars formed, planets formed around the stars. This is all condensation. Just like in the morning you'll see droplets of water condensing on a pane of glass. Well, similarly, you have this process producing the planets. Finally, chemical reactions occur and life forms, and then the life undergoes evolution, and finally we're here and we figure it all out. So that's the scientific theory. And what the up-to-date Mayavadis do is they grasp this onto the Mayavadi philosophy by identifying the most fundamental thing in the picture that you have in physics, namely this grand unified field of energy with Brahman. So they just say, well, that's Brahman. And so that's simple then. And then Brahman realization is to finally recognize that the only thing real is this infinite field of energy. And some add an additional feature to it. The idea is to bring in consciousness. Because actually, modern science as it stands really says nothing about consciousness, if you really come down to it. But you can sort of graft consciousness into the picture. And so this is done, for example, by a physicist named John Hagelin, who's connected with the TM movement. And he will say that one qualification of this infinite energy field is bliss. So it's a field of infinite bliss. And if you recognize that that's all there is, then you recognize the state of infinite bliss. So that's the present version. This is highly respectable. You'll find college professors who accept this and so forth. It's very much believable. Famous physicists like David Bohm present this philosophy, and so on and so forth. So the idea there, also George Wald gave an extremely eloquent presentation of this in some meetings we had. But these are impersonal conceptions of the absolute truth. In traditional Judeo-Christian thought, the concept of God that you really have at the core of the philosophy is basically the same sort of thing. Namely that God is some kind of impersonal force with will and knowledge, but not something really personal. So that concept is there, especially when you come to the more sophisticated ideas of the theologians. So what then is the difference between something personal and impersonal? Well, you'll see that the key feature presented in the Bhagavatam is that Krishna has bodily form. Persons ultimately have to have bodily form, one could say. You could imagine a disembodied mind that is just sort of all-pervading and just floating somehow. But in the Vedic literature, you find that the Supreme Absolute Truth has form. So Krishna is Satchitananda Vigraha. This form, however, is not made of matter. The thing that Shankaracharya did was to say, okay, Krishna has form, but that form is material. All form must be material. That's his dictum. So the actual philosophy, though, is that there is transcendental form. So Krishna is nirguna, which means he's devoid of any material qualities. And from the Mayavadi point of view, that means he must be devoid of any qualities whatsoever. So, of course, they would say Krishna is not nirguna. They would say, in fact, Krishna is saguna Brahman, with qualities. And nirguna Brahman is indescribable because it has no qualities. And anything you describe has qualities, because description means assigning qualities to things. So therefore, Brahman has no qualities. But actually, nirguna, Srila Prabhupada has pointed out, means no material qualities. So Krishna has an eternal bodily form, but that is completely non-material. So if you look at the Bhagavatam, you'll find that there are embodied forms that are personal at every level of the creation, both spiritual and material. And that is an interesting feature. Krishna does everything through personal form. And in principle, from an abstract point of view, he wouldn't have to do this. So there's the idea of God saying, let there be, and then there was. In Genesis and the Bible, there's this idea, God said, let there be light, and there was light, and so forth. There are various let there be's, and then things simply spring into being by the supreme will. So this is the concept that is sometimes presented. But it seems that Krishna doesn't do things that way, at least as far as the Bhagavatam is concerned. So from Krishna's original form, innumerable Vishnu forms expand, which have the same categorical level as Krishna, Vishnu Tattva. Among these, there's Karanadakshai Vishnu, and then Garbhadakshai Vishnu. In the creation of the material world, Karanadakshai Vishnu manifests innumerable universal globes, and he expands himself as Garbhadakshai Vishnu within each of those globes. And then Garbhadakshai Vishnu produces Brahma, but he also does this in a personal way. Namely, it's described that a lotus comes out of his navel and opens up, and then Brahma is there within the lotus flower, which is a little bit different from just abstractly saying, well, let there be Brahma, and there was Brahma. So the thing is done in a personal fashion. And then all of the different beings within the universe are created also through a process of personal generation coming from Brahma. So Brahma initially creates mental offspring, manasaputras, mind sons. So he, through his mind, Brahma generates these forms, and not only through his mind, but from different parts of his body. There's a whole description in the Bhagavatam. For example, from Brahma's thumb, Daksha was born, and so on. So from different parts of his body, different beings become manifest. So then from these beings, well, the first category of beings would be the Prajapatis. Prajapati means the lords of the Praja. Praja means all the different living beings. So they reproduce sexually after the level of Brahma. Generally, the method of sexual reproduction is used. But they produce different forms generation by generation. So it's an interesting description. I'm pointing all this out because it's related to the point that Krishna is personal and everything is done personally. So the Bhagavatam contains accounts of this information. Once you get beyond the initial creation of Brahma, the basic principle is that everything is generated by reproduction of bodies. But it can be looked at on an abstract and a concrete level. That is, the abstract principle is everything is done through bodily form. And then the concrete level involves the specific details. And the details exhibit a great deal of variation. And so the process becomes historical. So you have particular personalities involved. So, for example, there's the Prajapati named Daksha, who went through quite a history. So he was initially a direct son of Brahma, and then he got into trouble with Lord Shiva and became cursed. And he underwent penances for two lifetimes, Srila Prabhupada pointed out, after that, and then again was born as Daksha, that is, in the same form that he had previously. Except in this case, he was the son of the Prachetas. So he wasn't directly the son of Brahma. However, in the Chakshusha Manu period, it's described that Daksha produced different living entities. So in the Bhagavatam, there's a description of how that happened. There are various stages in that description. But finally, Daksha produced a number of daughters, and these became the wives of different demigods and Prajapatis. So 13 of them became wives of the Prajapati Kashyapa, who is a direct son of Brahma. And from them, it's described in the Bhagavatam how different life forms were produced. So this is interesting. There's a list in the Bhagavatam, and in fact there are some genealogical charts. But let's see. The basic point here is that different beings gave rise to different life forms. So it said, for example, Kashyapa, who was also named Tarksha, had four wives, Vinata, Kadru, Patangi, and Yamini. It's not that he only had four, but there were four in particular. Patangi gave birth to many kinds of birds, and Yamini gave birth to locusts. Vinata, Suparna, gave birth to Garuda, the carrier of Lord Vishnu, and to Anuru, or Aruna, the chariot driver of the sun god. Kadru gave birth to different varieties of serpents, and so forth. There are many different accounts like that. So that is described. More detail is given in other Puranas also. It may seem a little bit abrupt for Yamini to give birth to locusts. The details are interesting, though. In the Matsya Purana, there's also an account of these different daughters of Daksha and the different offspring that they had. Let's see. In particular, there's a fair amount of information here on different birds. For example, Kashyapa had this wife, Tamra. It didn't mention Tamra in this verse, but there's another verse mentioning Tamra. But specifically, Tamra had six daughters, it's mentioned, known as Shuki, Shani, Basi, Sugrivi, Gridrika, and Shuchi. These, in turn, had other daughters, for example, Shuka and Uluka. But now we're getting specific bird forms. Shuka, of course, refers to a parrot, and Uluka refers to an owl. Also, Shani, let's see, this refers to different kinds of eagles. We have here Gridra, which is vulture, Kapota, which is pigeon. These are different daughters. But these would be granddaughters of Tamra. So, the point is, more details are given. Also, it's described here where Jatayu comes in. Since we just heard about Jatayu in the Ramayana. Let's see, from Vinata, Kashyapa begot Garuda, who was just mentioned here, and Aruna. Sampati and Jatayu were the sons of Aruna. And then Vabru and Sigragra were the sons of Sampati. And then Jatayu, it is said, was the father of Kanikara, Satagami, Sarasa, Rajuvala, and Virunda. And then it says the above-mentioned sons of Jatayu became the ancestors of different species of birds. So you have a series of generations coming down. So that tells you how Jatayu fit into the picture. So in any case, the situation that you have is that according to the Bhagavatam, everything is directed personally at all levels of the creation of the universe. Now, according to the impersonal philosophies, you have some ultimate absolute cause, which is impersonal, and then somehow you have persons coming at some stage later on, which is a little bit difficult to comprehend as to just how that happens. In modern science, the way they deal with that is this concept of evolution, in which you say that you start with something impersonal, you wind up with chemicals in a primordial soup, and the chemicals get it together and form a cell. practically everyone is believing this in modern universities, even though it's incredibly hard to understand how that could work. You can see that if you study cells. Actually, the biochemists have provided the best arguments against this theory of origin of life from chemicals, because they find that within cells there are incredibly complicated machines. It's quite amazing. For example, the ribosome. All proteins within cells are produced by ribosomes. And ribosomes, in turn, are produced from proteins, particular ones, plus RNA. So, in order to get the ribosome, you have to have the proteins. And in order to get the proteins, you have to have the ribosome, plus the RNA. So, how did that get started? And then the problem is the ribosome is an incredibly complicated machine. It has an editing and proofreading mechanism. Editors will appreciate this, which edits the proteins as they're produced. So if there's error, then the thing is kicked out and destroyed by appropriate enzymes so that you have proper accuracy. And without this editing system, it would produce erroneous proteins, and the cell would die almost immediately because all its proteins would have errors in them. So how did that get started just from chemicals? Well, somehow it must have happened. That is the explanation. Yes. Well, I've heard that argument, by the way. I've actually heard that. I was presenting some of these problems with origin of life to one scientist, and he said he was a very logical scientist. He'd learned how to think logically, and he said that, well, obviously, this evolution did take place because we're here. So that proves it. So, in any case, a general problem you have with the impersonal philosophies is that how do you go from the impersonal, whatever it is, to the person? This is difficult. It seems to me that Shankaracharya has that problem too. He has to go from this undescribable Brahman to Maya, including Krishna. So how do you do that? Well, the only way he does it is by saying that actually the Maya doesn't exist. It's just an illusion. But then, of course, what is it that's an illusion? Because you would think an illusion requires someone who is an illusion. And Brahman cannot be an illusion. And apart from Maya, Brahman is the only thing you've got. So there's a problem there. There are a lot of problems. So the solution in the Bhagavatam is that you start with personality. That's where it all begins, with an eternal, original person. And then everything is personal from there on down. Of course, this also creates problems when it comes to modern science again, because then the Bhagavatam is saying everything is controlled by personal power. But the scientists will say, well, it looks as though everything is happening according to impersonal laws. So how do you reconcile those two things? So I won't say anything more about that in this class. So that's because it's getting late. Are there any questions? Yeah?
Well, I actually have two questions. One of them has to do with the extension of purport that there's these three potential reactions during this pastime. So we've all heard the pastime. What kind of energy? And if somebody can do there is we need to become three potential reactions. So it seems like we'd be in a different position for myself, I'd be in a different state and I can't stand.
So the question for those in the kitchen is if by hearing this pastime we immediately become free from sinful reactions, how come we're still so evidently sinful, at least in terms of what goes on in our minds, if I can infer from Father Narayan's question. And the suffering, yeah. Why are we suffering like this? Well, one question is, what does immediately mean? That's one point to make. If, as a result of hearing these pastimes, we go back to Godhead at the end of this life, say hypothetically, that's pretty immediate, if you consider that we've been within the material world for uncountable births, from the point of view of the time we've been here, that's just instantaneous, practically. So that would be one point. Another point is that Srila Prabhupada said in the purport that you have to actually become absorbed in these pastimes. Where did I just read that? So it's perhaps not enough to hear it merely by having the sounds pass through the tympanic membranes of the ears. Well, he says, if one simply gives oral reception to the narration and accepts the glories of the Lord, then he is qualified. The impersonalist philosophers cannot understand the glories of the Lord, etc., etc. These narrations are not for them. So they can hear them too. But the situation of how you hear is important. All you have to do is accept the glories of the Lord. Now, the question is, what does it require to accept them? So one can think about that. Then there's the problem, if you're sinful, maybe that means you don't really accept them. And not accepting them, then how can you become free of sin by hearing the pastime? Anyway, you had a question? Well, you're arguing that logical arguments won't do anything for non-devotees. But that depends. You see, there are non-devotees who actually in their heart have something against being a devotee. And that's true. Logical arguments won't do anything for them because they don't want to hear it. But there are people out there who are bewildered. They could be devotees, but they're not because they're still confused. Logical arguments can help them. That's what the logical arguments are really for. Helping people who are on the edge. They could become devotees or they may remain non-devotees because within their minds they're bewildered. They're confused by all this maya. So if you can straighten things out logically and clarify things for them, then they can approach the devotional service. So when you say the non-devotees need to associate with the devotee, well, that's the first phase of the association, really. Because if the non-devotee initially has no faith, then he's not going to chant Hare Krishna. And what is his association with devotees really going to amount to? But if the devotee explains things to him logically and clearly, and then he says, oh yeah, maybe there's something to that. So maybe I'll try this chanting. And from that association of devotees, then he has a chance to become a devotee. And then when he becomes a devotee and gets a little bit purified, then he can make further progress. He can chant more purely. And that brings one back to the answer to Bhadri Narayan's question, because initially, if these things are explained logically and clearly, so you can begin to put some faith in them, then you get a little bit of that benefit. As a result, you become purified, so you can put more faith in these narrations and so forth. Then you get more benefit and you become more purified, and so forth. Yeah? Yeah, sure, go right ahead. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, first of all, Srila Prabhupada, in fact, gave many logical arguments. He was definitely had a program of giving logical arguments to people in general. I remember at the end of the first New York Rathi Yatra, we'd gone all the way down Fifth Avenue with the Rathi Yatra carts, and Srila Prabhupada gave the lecture. The entire lecture was the argument from design. That's all he talked about, pointing out how the sun, you know, is providing just enough heat for the earth to function. You know, if it was too hot, we'd burn up. If it was too cold, we'd freeze. So everything is adjusted just right. The rain is adjusted so that, you know, the crops can grow and so forth. You could have torrential floods or droughts, but everything is adjusted. Our lives totally depend on these things. So he was going on and on, giving all these arguments, saying there must be a designer. How could this just be happening? So these were logical arguments. So Srila Prabhupada would do that. Now the point as to the, regarding the Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada pointed out that indeed we see life coming from light. So he was saying it's logical then to say that as you go back, it must be a similar process all the way back to an original life. That makes sense, he was saying. Whereas we've never seen life come from non-life. Nor can we even understand how that could work. So this just elaborates that. You can elaborate it in two ways. You can say, one, the Bhagavatam is explaining how you go all the way back to an original source of life. But that involves these demigods and so forth. One question is, well, how in the world do you get all these birds and fish and cows and so forth starting from Krishna? There are some steps in there that seem a little bit puzzling, how you get the animal forms. It's actually explained in the Bhagavatam, and that's why I was mentioning these descriptions. There's descent through different forms, and it's quite gradual and very detailed if you really get into it. So that's just filling in the gaps there. Now, maybe we don't see all of that, but logically, you can infer, if it goes generation by generation and you keep going back, you've got to go generation by generation until there's an original state of life. And then that's gone. That would be the original life, logically speaking. Even, Thomas Aquinas argued like that with his original cause arguments and so forth. Well, he created them, but this is how he created them. Everything involves bodily form at every stage. He could have just created Brahma, like I mentioned, but he didn't. He produced Brahma from the lotus flower and so forth. So, well, all glories to Prabhupada.